Point Monday on 88.5 FM and WMNF.org. I'm Sean Canaan. At least two Black Lives Matter protesters in Tampa have been struck by vehicles in the last few months. Today, we'll speak with their lawyer. And then later on in the show, today is the first day of classes in at least three Tampa Bay area counties. Many students, teachers, and school staff are attending in-person classes during a deadly pandemic. We'll speak to a Pinellas County teacher who feels so strongly that it's not safe yet to return to classrooms that she has taken a leave of absence. We'll take your calls. Here's the number if you'd like to get in on the queue. The number is 813-239-9663. You can also email DJ@WMNF.org. You can text 813-433-0885. And I want to thank everyone who helped make our two-day fundraising drive a success. We did pass our goal. There's still time for you to contribute if you'd like at WMNF.org. So first up, we're going to look at the Black Lives Matter movement and the troubling trend of protesters being struck by vehicles. There are at least two incidents in Tampa. In June, activist Jay Passmore was struck by a red pickup truck, and then later the same month, a man was rammed by a slow-moving vehicle and fell onto its hood. The driver kept moving and carried him away until a car was stopped by police. The driver was not charged. Today we speak to the lawyer for those two protesters, and the lawyer is Gretchen Cothran. Thank you so much, and welcome back to WMNF's Midpoint, Gretchen.
Thank you, Sean.
Well, we heard you on Shelley and Janet's show and on Rob's Radioactivity in the last few months, but I'm glad you can come back on now to talk about the latest news, because on Thursday, new video came out, well, at least it was new to me, of the collision that injured Jay Passmore. And so I'm going to, in just a few seconds, I'm going to play the audio from that video, and then I'll have you describe what happened. But in this video, if people can see it online at WMNF.org, you can see a red pickup truck pulling onto the wrong side of the street, and then hear its tires peel out as it speeds toward protesters, and then you can hear the impact as the front of the truck hits protester Jay Passmore. So let's play that sound right now, and then we'll be back to talk about it.
Sure.
All right, maybe we don't have it, but we'll save that for later, I guess. And after Jay was hit by the pickup truck, she screamed and ricocheted off the front corner of the truck into another protester and onto the ground. The truck then sped away. Before she was struck, you can hear Passmore saying, "I'm ready to die for what I believe in, because he goes and runs me over. That's going to be what it is." And so Gretchen Cothran, an attorney for Jay Passmore, what is it that, why did you end up taking this case?
I took it initially to help Jay through the system of trying to get CPD to investigate the case. And now, of course, it's developed into something much more than that. But that initially it was to help her, and it's because I believe in her, and I believe in what she's trying to do.
And when you say to have TPD, that's Tampa Police Department, investigate the case, there's not been an arrest made yet, right?
Correct.
What have you heard from Tampa Police?
Tampa Police Department, Jay and I went, I want to say about a week after it happened, and gave a two-hour interview to Tampa Police Department outlining what happened, what occurred, what information we had on the case. Tampa Police Department requested that pretty much that we do an investigation to determine who was the driver of the truck. So far, to my knowledge, I don't believe that they have even interviewed the person that owns that pickup truck.
How easy has it been to get information about your client's rights with regard to this case from Tampa Police?
Tampa Police Department is not giving us any updates at all. They have not been cooperating with us at all.
I just want to remind people that our guest is lawyer Gretchen Cothran. She is the attorney for two protesters in Tampa who were hit. And the reason I'm bringing her back on, she's been on other shows in the previous two or three months, is because of this, new to me at least, video that came out last Thursday night, which clearly shows this red truck. I just want to make sure I'm describing it accurately to people. The red truck crosses over the into the wrong lane of traffic and strikes, you know, heads toward a group of protesters and actually strikes Jay Passmore and then speeds off. That's what happened, right, in the video?
Yeah. Yes. And what happened, what led up to the video, that prior to the video being shot, was that he had gotten out of his truck and was yelling at the protesters using language that I can't repeat, but pretty much saying F, Black Lives Matter, threatening to run them down. And then that's when you hear Ms. Passmore respond back to him, if you're going to run me down, you're going to run me down. And that's why she said what she said, was in response to him. Then he got back in the truck, and as you see in the video, he not only went up the wrong side of the road, he could, you know, he was being inconvenienced. If he was angry, he could have made a U-turn. He could have taken a right or a left on Rome, which he passed when he was trying to run down Ms. Passmore. It didn't need to be what he brought it to.
And the way I found out about this video is that on Thursday night, attorney Benjamin Crump released it. And now Benjamin Crump is a famous attorney who has represented a lot of families of people who are have been killed by police or injured by police or injured by other people. For example, he's representing right now Breonna Taylor's family and so on. But how did he get involved in this case?
I reached out to him to ask for help. And so I'm a criminal defense attorney. That initially I got involved with Ms. Passmore to help her with the investigation with the Tampa Police Department. And the reason for that was is that she was afraid to even go in and interview, because, and I was also afraid for her. We were afraid that if she went into Tampa Police Department for the interview, they were going to turn around and blame her for getting hit and possibly charge her with having been in the crosswalk, in the street. So that's how I got involved. So when it became this, you know, this big issue where Tampa Police Department is one not investigating and it's become a civil rights issue, I reached out to Mr. Crump and asked him to come on board because that's his expertise, not mine.
So how did you find out that Benjamin Crump was going to get involved in this case?
Yeah, so I emailed him and I sent him the video. Jay and I had not released the video. That particular video, the police department has had. The FBI has it. We gave it to them, but we did not release it because it's very traumatic today to see it. But I sent it to Mr. Crump via email. And he responded back, OMG, we need to talk. And he called me. It was about 10 o'clock at night on Wednesday, and he called me, and we had a brief discussion on the case. And then Thursday, we had a conference call with him, Jay Passmore, myself, and he came on board to help us.
And we do have the video ready to play, the audio from that video, so I just wanted to play that now so people who haven't seen it can get a little bit of context about what you're hearing about the screeching tires as the truck, this red truck, screams towards Jay Passmore. I mean, it's a small residential street. It's not a super highway or anything, so I don't know how fast it's going, but it's going very fast, as you can tell, and then it hits her, and then it speeds away. So let's play that audio right now.
I'm ready to die for what I believe in. So if he comes and run me over, that'll be what it is.
Screams are Jay Passmore after she was struck by the truck and then thrown into another protester and then hit the ground, and she's still injured. How are her injuries? This is 2 months ago.
She's still going through medical treatment. She was initially diagnosed with a concussion. She has been going through tests for pain to her pelvic area and her groin, and she was in a wheelchair for about a week. And then on crutches for a month with a, and I'm probably not going to get this terminology correct. It was either a sprained or a strained ankle. But she was in a boot for a month for that.
And our guest is Gretchen Cawthorn. She's an attorney for Jay Passmore and also for someone else we'll talk about in just a few minutes, Jason Stewart Flores. Those two protesters have been struck by cars this summer in Tampa, and we just played video of the first one that happened. This was Juneteenth weekend, so around the 19th or so of June, so more than 2 months ago. And I asked about Jay's injuries because she was re-injured in an encounter with Tampa police just recently, just this month. I'll ask you, what happened? What made or what transpired, that is, when the Tampa police went after Jay in downtown Tampa about a week and a half ago?
Yes, so Jay had been at Gaslight Park, which is near Tampa Police Department off of Franklin near Kennedy, and she was with the group Food Not Bombs, which feeds the homeless down there every week. So she was there at a group of people from that had been at the Back to Blue mural, came over to the park and started harassing and antagonizing the people feeding the homeless. To my knowledge, I mean, we really don't know what transpired to have police run up out of unmarked cars and tackle Jay, throw her to the ground to arrest her. The criminal report affidavit from Tampa Police Department states that Jay had smacked someone in the back of the head with an open palm. That didn't happen. Tampa Police Department then released on their YouTube page a video of, and I'll say it's a partial video because Tampa Police Department cut out about 2 minutes of the beginning of the video, where there was a man that kept getting into Jay's personal space as she was walking, trying to leave the area. He kept jumping in front of her and stopping right in front of her in an obvious attempt to have her run into him. She put her hand on his shoulder and away. However, that video that Tampa Police Department released, that's not what she's accused of. She's accused of smacking someone in the back.
Our guest is Gretchen Cawthorn, who is an attorney for Jay Passmore, who was, in the incident we're talking about right now, arrested pretty forcefully in the middle of nowhere, out of nothing. She wasn't doing anything at that exact time. And let me play a short video of what we were just talking about, this arrest that happened where she fell to the ground or was thrown to the ground, and Tampa police kneeled on her shoulder while they were arresting her. So let's listen to what that sounded like. Well, this, you were talking about how the Back the Blue mural. That was part of the audio from the video that you said that that was on Instagram, but then also the police released an edited video as well of what had happened when they were kneeling on Jay's shoulder. And she was further injured then. She had to go to the hospital as well. Isn't that right?
Yeah. She went from the scene of the alleged arrest straight to the hospital.
This is near what you were talking about, a Back the Blue mural. This was painted on the streets in downtown Tampa, and so all of this seemed to have happened a short time after there was verbal confrontation, at least, and maybe some shoving between people from this Food Not Bombs group that Jay was a part of and the Back the Blue people. What do we know about that group, the group that was there that day?
Well, from the video, we saw people, the Back the Blue group, wearing vests that said Blue Thunder, Back the Blue. And we've done research on them. That is a law enforcement biker gang that only allows to become a member. You must be male, and you must be active or retired law enforcement, and you have to prove it. So that group that was there antagonizing the protesters, these are law enforcement officers. They weren't just a support group out to support Back the Blue. So the man who kept stepping into Jay's path, trying to cause her to hit him, that's entrapment. He knew exactly what he was doing. And it just floors me that these are law enforcement officers dressing up like bikers to support the Back the Blue mural and harassing and antagonizing a nonprofit group that is feeding the homeless.
Our guest is Gretchen Cawthorn, and she's an attorney for Jay Passmore and for Stuart Flores, who will, Jason Stuart Flores, that is, who we'll talk about in a moment, two protesters who have been struck by cars this summer in Tampa. And I should say that our reporter, Daniel Figueroa, is working on a story about protesters in St. Petersburg, who he's following up on a story that we've done about protesters in St. Petersburg who are also concerned about being hit by cars, or at least threatened with cars. And so if that's happened to you, or if you know about this, please give us a call, 813-239-9663, and let us know, or send us an email, dj@wmnf.org. So let's now talk about about Mr. Flores. This is a different incident, also in June, where he was struck by a car at a protest, and then he was carried for several blocks. What happened?
Yes. And Stuart, he goes by Stuart. Stuart's case is a prime example of why Ms. Passmore was afraid and reluctant to talk to Tampa Police Department after she got hit by a car. So Mr. Flores he's Native American. He was performing a Native American blessing ritual, which involves the burning sage, when he was struck. The car that struck him was on Albany, South Albany, right near the Winn-Dixie. So again, the car did not need to drive through the protest. It could have gone through the Winn-Dixie parking lot and exited on Swan, as opposed to exiting on Albany. The car was a Volkswagen, and it drove through. It hit several protesters before it hit Stuart, including one protester, Mr. Gonzalez, who, when he was hit, he broke the windshield of the Volkswagen. The car proceeded through the protest and hit Stewart, causing him to fly up on the hood. At the time Stewart was healing, he has pins in his ankle from a broken ankle. So he was healing from a broken ankle and he got hit by this car. When he landed on the hood of the car proceeded to turn onto Swan, accelerate speed, and start swerving down Swan, trying to throw him off the hood of the car. The car stopped near the bar Irish 31, and where Stewart was taken off the car by police and immediately arrested for causing damage to the car that hit him.
Even though it was a different person who allegedly caused that damage, doesn't appear that Stewart caused any of the damage to the car, right?
Correct. We know that by videos and also by an interview that Mr. Gonzalez gave, that he was the one that was hit first, and that when he got hit, he punched the windshield, cracking the windshield of the car, not breaking it, but cracking it. So we do know, just by looking at the video, that when the car hit Stewart, the windshield was already cracked. He did not cause that.
Our guest is Gretchen Cawthorn. She's an attorney for Jay Passmore and Jason Stuart Flores, two protesters who have been struck by cars this summer in Tampa. And if you'd like to join the conversation, the number is 813-239-9663. You can text us at 813-433-0885, or you can email us at dj@wmnf.org. You're listening to WMNF Tampa. It's 12:24 in the afternoon. My name is Sean Canan. You're listening to Midpoint Monday. And I apologize. You're representing them in a criminal case, but at least for Jay is being represented by Benjamin Crump. Is that right, that there's going to be a civil case against the city?
That I can't speak to as to what Mr. Crump is going to do, but I would imagine something needs to be done to get Tampa Police Department to investigate the case and arrest the driver. At the very least, the driver left the scene of a hit and run, left the scene of an accident. That's a misdemeanor. He could be facing attempted murder. You see in the video that he aimed directly at Ms. Passmore, went around, drove around white protesters to hit Ms. Passmore, who is black. So that could be attempted murder. It could be battery with a deadly weapon. There are a multitude of crimes he committed that day, and the fact that he has not been arrested leads me to some suspicion that not only police know who he is, but maybe he's one of their own. I'm wondering why they're protecting him.
We've heard Jay call for Tampa Police Chief Brian Dugan to be removed from office. There's also some calls from activists for Tampa's former police chief and current mayor to step aside, and they've said that they would start a recall petition for recalling the mayor of Tampa, Jane Castor. What else are the protesters, your clients, asking for?
They're asking for equality. They're asking for a reform of the Tampa Police Department. Tampa Police Department, in my years as a criminal defense attorney, they are known as being a hard-hitting, very mean police department. They are known. The other police departments in our county and in neighboring counties that I work in do not have the reputation of Tampa Police Department. So they're calling for something to be done, reform needs to be done in that department to stop this culture of hate that the department seems to have towards minorities and towards lower-income people in general.
Our guest is Gretchen Cawthorn, who's an attorney for Jay Passmore and Jason Stewart Flores, two protesters who have been struck by cars this summer in Tampa. I'm going to take a call in just a second, but let me read this text message that just came in from Jeff in Newport Richey. Jeff says, I don't know if your guest is lying on purpose or if she's just fully misinformed, but the Blue Thunder is not a biker gang. You do not have to be a male to join, and you do not have to be and prove that you are former or current law enforcement. Ever since she said about Blue Thunder is a lie. So that's what Jeff in Newport Richey is saying about Blue Thunder, that those things that you are saying weren't true.
Well, the information that I have comes directly from the Blue Thunder Motorcycle Club, as they call themselves, website. So maybe Jeff wants to get in touch with Blue Thunder and have them correct their website if what I'm saying is incorrect, because that comes straight from their website.
And we have a call from John in Sarasota. Hi, John. Welcome to WMNF Midpoint. What would you like to say, John?
Hey, yeah. Can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, I just want to say that I believe in freedom of speech, and I believe in people that can protest and all that. But, you know, some people need to be places. And when you're on the road and you're in, I've called about this before, some people are scared. They're afraid for their life, and they're going to do whatever they can to get away. So get the heck off the road. Tell the protesters to stay off the dang road. Protest on the sidewalk and stay off the road and let people do what they ought to do.
Hey, John, I'm going to let my guest answer in just a second. John,
it needs to end.
Hey, John, I'm talking. I'm going to let my guest answer in just a second, but I want to ask you one question. Have you seen the video that I'm talking about where the red truck pulls out from the line of traffic and pulls into the other side of the road and then strikes Jay Passmore?
Yeah, that guy's an idiot. He did it on purpose. You know that. I mean, I don't agree with that. That's what I'm saying. I don't approve of that at all, but protesters need to stay off the freaking road. Let people get to where they need to get, and everything will be fine.
All right. Thank you for the call, John. I really, really appreciate it. Gretchen, before I let you go, is there anything you'd like to respond about what either John, well, you've already responded to Jeff, but what John just said there from that call?
Yes, and I would just say that protests historically will block traffic. The reason for that is that they're trying to get the attention of people who are not affected otherwise by what's going on. You know, in South Tampa, and that's the big reason for protesting in Hyde Park, is those of us who are privileged enough to live in South Tampa, we don't deal with what the people of East Tampa, Seminole Heights, Sulphur Springs, we don't deal with what they deal with on a daily basis. So we don't see the inequality. We don't have police run up to us and throw us to the ground. That just doesn't happen to us. So historically, protests will go into the affluent neighborhoods, where we're not affected by the police brutality. And that's to get our attention. And in both of the cases, both Mr. Flores' case and Ms. Passmore's case, cars had the opportunity to make a U-turn or go a different direction. In neither case did the people in vehicles have any reason to be afraid. They made the decision to drive through a protest.
the protesters were not surrounding their vehicles. No one was kicking, hitting their vehicles, threatening them. In both of these instances, the drivers were the ones who made the decision to impact the protest and to drive through the protest. And I will respond to the man who emailed or wrote about Blue Thunder. So the website bluethunderemc.org, as its membership, qualify as a law enforcement member or an associate member, be male, own and ride an American-made motorcycle, and it goes on and on. But that's their organization website that lists those qualifications to be a member of the motorcycle club.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us on WMNF's Midpoint Monday, Gretchen.
Thank you very much, Mr. Kinane.
I'm glad you could join us. Gretchen Cawthorn is an attorney for Jay Passmore and Jason Stewart Flores, two protesters who have been struck by cars this summer in Tampa. You're listening to WMNF's Midpoint Monday on 88.5 FM. My name is Sean Canaan. It's 12:32 in the afternoon. In just a few minutes, we're going to be joined by our next guest. She's a Pinellas teacher who is so concerned about a potential coronavirus outbreak in schools that she is taking a leave of absence. After she went back for the planning week, she decided that it was not safe to teach kids in classes. We're going to talk to her in just a few minutes after I play a story from our own reporter, Daniel Figueroa. He filed this on Friday. As students, teachers, and school staff return to in-person classrooms, WMNF's Daniel Figueroa IV reports many teachers are adjusting to change and they're making sacrifices in and out of the classroom.
Gaurav Harshe is an international student.
All right, well, if we had the other one lined up, we could hear that story that comes from...
According to the Florida Department of Health.
All right, so the teachers return, Daniel's, is about the teachers adjusting to change and making sacrifices in and out of the classroom.
Lakewood High School math teacher Melissa Ostrowski loves her family and her students. In a normal year, she'd see her sister and two-year-old niece at least once a week. Every month, a visit with her grandparents. And in a normal year, she'd be there for the birth of her nephew in a few weeks. But it's not a normal year.
That will have to stop. I won't be able to see her or her two-year-old or her new baby until she feels comfortable enough. Kids need us more than anything, so... If that comes at the cost of, okay, my family won't see me for a month, to me, coming back for a temporary life change, it is worth it. I think the kids need us.
Ostrowski is one of the many thousands of educators in Florida and more across the country making tough choices as in-person learning starts for the first time since spring. By the end of August, in-person learning should be in place throughout Florida, even as COVID-19 cases in the state near 600,000 and deaths past 10,000. But to educators on the front lines, changing times don't change the mission. Cypress Creek Middle School counselor Emily Cooper.
For me personally, I want to get back to be here for the kids. You know, as much as I might have my hesitation about returning and be nervous about what might happen, I'm ready to be here and do what I have to do.
The first day of school will look different than most can remember. Each district has new protocols in place to limit exposure and enact social distancing measures. Elizabeth Brown Davis, a special education teacher at Lockhart Elementary in Tampa and a 30-year teaching veteran in Florida and New York, said this is the strangest school opening she's seen. And that includes being a teacher in New York during 9/11.
I lived through 9/11, even like colleagues talking about Katrina. During this time, we've collected so many stories, testimonies, and my colleagues in Louisiana said even Katrina wasn't anywhere near this. And it's because even after the horrific event, we went back to almost a normal way. And this is it seems like we'll never go back to the way things were, which could be a good thing.
Brown Davis teaches in a school with a large African-American and lower-income population, factors she said that add to the stress felt by students and teachers. She spent much of her summer reaching out to organizations to help students get virtual learning equipment and volunteered her time to familiarize families with virtual learning.
We see populations of families that are socially and economically disadvantaged have a higher need. They would, of course, need devices. They need broadband or internet connectivity, and they also require the know-how.
Ostrowski admits it's a little easier to work with high school kids who might be more comfortable with technology. And that'll allow her to keep the rigors of her high-level math classes.
I work in a magnet program that has a level of rigor that needs to be upheld, and I plan to do that whether you're in my classroom or on my computer. Figuring out how to do that is a bit of a challenge, but I'm not going to lower my standard because of what's going on in the world.
Even as students return to classrooms, that could change. There's still the potential of outbreaks, and there's even an ongoing lawsuit challenging whether putting teachers at risk by opening schools is even constitutional. Cypress Creek's Cooper said one of the major stressors has been preparing for that change.
I think we're going to wind up having a lot of changes take place right away, looking at how other schools have gone through it already and some of the outcomes of that. It is a concern that we're going to have to change everything and possibly go back online. At that time, it'll be kind of just figuring out how to do the shift back to virtual.
Change and adaptability is part of the job, Ostrowski said. These plans are brand new, untested, and unprecedented, but you've just got to remember your training.
We're already trained to roll with the punches. It's just different punches that no one's ever experienced before.
For WMNF, I'm Daniel Figueroa IV.
Well, thanks, Daniel, for that story about how teachers are adjusting to in-person classes during the coronavirus pandemic. Many students are going back to in-person classes this morning in Pinellas and Pasco counties. This week, Hillsborough students and teachers start the year online. Last week, Manatee County students started back in person. Already, at least 9 schools have reported COVID-19 cases in Manatee County. That's according to the Bradenton Herald. And I'd like to hear from you about the reopening of schools. Do you have a student in school? Did you pick online or in-person learning? Are you a teacher or a staff member at a school? Give us a call, 813-239-9663. You're listening to WMNF Tampa. This is Midpoint Monday. I'm Sean Canaan, and our next guest is a teacher. You've heard her on this show before. She helped to organize the teachers' protests outside Pinellas School District's building, asking that there not be a return to in-person instruction until after the coronavirus danger had passed. And now she's back because of new developments. Christy Faust is a high school science teacher in Pinellas County. Welcome back to WMNF's Midpoint Monday, Christy.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me, Sean.
I'm glad that you are here. I'm glad you came on the show. And the reason I invited you back on is because of what happened when you did go back to work about a week and a half ago during teacher planning days and before students arrived. During that time, what you saw and what you felt, you made the decision to take a leave of absence. Why?
Yeah, I did. The last school board meeting was like 2 days before we started, and part of me was really hopeful that they would make a vote to go back virtually. And so when that didn't happen, I wanted to go and see what it looked like, see what it felt like, before making that decision to put in for the leave. And just when I got there, seeing the desks still all very close together, imagining at the school I was teaching at, they estimated about 1,000 students would be coming back to campus, which is about a little over half of what we normally have. But imagining that quantity of people on campus and just knowing that there's no way to social distance. And then also in some of the trainings and seeing adults around the campus, folks just aren't wearing their masks properly. And also seeing that at the school board meeting, that the administrators and the school board members had saggy masks and those sorts of things. So if adults are having problems wearing their masks properly, how are kids going to be able to do that? And then the sheer quantity of people on some of our campuses, it's just not safe. I made that decision for myself.
And so beginning today, you're going to be off for a year from your teaching position. That's what you've decided, right, to take a year off?
Well, the the constraints of the leave of absence is that it's a year leave of absence, I guess I'll say. So, I mean, if conditions changed and they invited me back, I would be happy to, you know, potentially come back to a virtual position. That is what I applied. You know, I requested a virtual position and I was turned down. So that's why I chose to, you know, that I felt impelled to take the leave of absence. So, but from what I understand, that they will be expecting a full year, even if conditions change. So I might be mistaken about that. But
so that's something you just said there confuses me, because I remember hearing, I believe it was Governor Ron DeSantis say, "Hey, look, if teachers feel that it's unsafe to go back, they can just teach online, and they have that option." And you said that was the option that you chose, and your school district or your school itself said, no, that's not an option for you?
Right. Yeah, I put in to teach solely the MyPCS, which is a virtual, which was, when it was first presented, it was presented as, you know, fully virtual. And what's happened instead is many, maybe even most, I don't know exactly, but many teachers are teaching what they're calling simultaneous in Pinellas, which means that you have both face-to-face classes as well as online classes at the same time. So even though I technically had the MyPCS option, that I would also have face-to-face students, and I didn't feel safe with that. So, yeah, it sort of changed. But, I put in for that, and, you know, I did ask about it. And, you know, the scheduling and things like that, I couldn't be accommodated. So, you know, I had to choose my safety and also my convictions with feeling that it's unsafe to go back.
We're speaking with Christy Faust, the high school science teacher in Pinellas County, right now on leave of absence. And, you know, I want to explore a little bit what that would look like when a teacher is teaching a class full of students. I'll use the word full for a second. I mean, it might be fewer than normal, but it's quite a number of students in a classroom. And at the same time, looking at a computer screen and a camera and teaching students at the same time in a kind of a Zoom-type meeting.
Right. Yeah, that's basically what the expectation is. And again, in me making, you know, I want to say it was a choice, but it was a pressured choice, right? If we were going back to full virtual, I'd be teaching today. So since that environment, the simultaneous learning model is what they kind of came up with instead, you know, more and more impossible things kept getting piled onto us. So first of all, we already know it's unsafe for COVID anyway, if you put a lot of people in a small space, but now you're asking me to divert my attention into two different locations. I can't take care of the kids in the room if I'm focusing on a screen, or vice versa. It's not something that can be done. Like, it takes two different, like, skill sets, I guess. So I'm very sure that folks are going to make it happen in some way. But when I was listening, you know, before you and I started speaking, I heard someone say, you know, we're going to make this happen and all that stuff. You can make it happen, or high levels of rigor. I'm not convinced that you're going to be able to have that if you're doing simultaneous, because you can't give all of the attention in both places at the same time. It's just impossible.
Our guest is Christy Faust, a high school science teacher in Pinellas, and you're listening to 88.5 FM WMNF in Tampa. My name is Sean Canana, and this is Midpoint Monday. It's 12:44 in the afternoon, and we'd like to hear what you think about schools reopening, students having in-person instruction. You mentioned something earlier, Christy, which was about the seating, and you posted a photo on your blog with some lab tables set up in your science classroom, and so the lab tables were socially distanced from each other, but there were four seats at each of those lab tables, which means the students would almost literally be in each other's faces if it were completely full. What can you tell us about that setup in your that was physically in your classroom versus about how many students were in the largest classes that you were assigned to?
Right. The picture I posted, our plant operators did come and get the extra chairs. So that left approximately, the biggest class I had was something like 20 students. But my perception of that is that you still would not be socially distant. If we're talking 6 feet away from each other, students will still not have that going on. Another thing that they added on Friday was plexiglass barriers. So those are in there now as well. So I just want to be transparent and honest about that. They did come and, you know, fix some of that stuff. I will say, so even last year I brought this up with some folks. So, you know, rooms have a maximum rating, you know, like for the fire marshal and that sort of thing, right? Maximum occupancy. For my classroom, the sign says 21. So my largest class has 20, and then if you add the teacher in, that's 21. So that fire marshal rating or whatever is, that's under normal circumstances anyway. And I'll tell you, like, under non-COVID sorts of periods, I definitely had more students than that. But they're basically putting the maximum capacity for the room rating now, but within COVID, right? So, like, it's not, you can't socially distance. You will not be 6 feet apart from people in that room. And the barriers that I put up, considering it's an airborne virus, specifically that gets transferred through, like, aerosols, you know, it's just all of these things that kind of gives the illusion of safety. Yes, we're trying to keep kids apart, but are we keeping them far enough apart? Are we truly, you know, truly making them safe? My answer is still no. Even with seeing these other things coming in, it's still not safe for them. Even with pulling chairs and putting up some plexiglass.
Yeah, and reading on the blog on your blog about the plexiglass, it doesn't instill a lot of confidence either, because one of them broke and the person installing it fixed it with masking tape.
Yeah, which, I mean, like, it will fix it, but they broke that easily. All he was doing was putting the base on it, and one of the things chipped, so, and, you know, a pretty good chunk, which, again, just knowing what a classroom is like and just having bodies in a room and that sort of thing, kids are going to bump into them, they're going to break, so, you know, it's not that anything's wrong, but it's not the most, I don't trust it. If those plexiglass things last a week, I'll be pretty impressed with that.
Our guest is Christy Faust. She's a high school science teacher in Pinellas County, and this is WMNF's Midpoint Monday. And I think a lot of people might be wondering right now whether maybe you just made a light decision and you can just take a year off or however long it ends up being, no problem. But I don't want to get too personal, but I think it'd be fair to say this is going to be a financial hardship for you.
Absolutely. I am fortunate that I still up a bit of sick leave, so I will be able to use that first. So I've got a little bit of a cushion. But yeah, I am not independently wealthy. I'm going to be on my own. So as I'm doing all of this, it's the first Monday back, so I can't say I've been looking too much, but I will be looking for ways to get by, and I'll be looking for other work. So this wasn't taken lightly. I am child free, so I don't have to worry about other folks. So I am a little freer than some are that way. So I just have to worry about myself. But this is a very risky thing for me. I don't have a ton of savings and all of that. So walking and, the other side of this is the career. It took me 30 years to figure out that I wanted to do it. I just became a high school teacher 5 years ago. And, you know, I had gotten a master's degree and a PhD in biology before doing that. So, you know, I finally find a career I love. And then I feel like the government has forced me in this position where I feel like I have to walk away, partially for my own safety, but partially to make a point that some of the stuff we don't have to subject ourselves to this. So it's a scary thing to do. It's a scary thing for me to walk away from all of that, but I don't feel like I can contribute my energy and my labor to a situation that could potentially make my students sick or my coworkers sick and that sort of thing. So, yeah, so it was definitely a hard decision. I mean, I was crying last week once it really hit me that I wasn't going to get to see my students or, you know, get to interact with them this year and that sort of thing. So it's been really hard.
And you write that politicians have been on the attack for decades and are using COVID-19 to further dismantle public education. What is this connection that you're making on your blog here about how politicians are using COVID-19 to dismantle public education?
I mean, slowly but surely, the GOP certainly has had an agenda of privatizing education. I feel like the push to get us to be in, partially in virtual even, but this hybrid that we have to open, like, oh my goodness, we have to open, the economy has to open, is just a way certainly to destabilize things and to send this message that we have to put ourselves in these unsafe conditions. So it's a little off question, but just we don't. What our government should be doing is supporting us and providing safety nets so that we can have, like, we can end COVID. Very honestly, if the Senate and whatever passed a budget that would allow us to stay home for like 3 months or something like that, COVID would be done and we could open reopen safely and it would be fine. But they're sending this message that we must do this thing. And it's just not true. So I don't know. There's a lot. There's so many pieces going into that. I don't feel like I can hone in completely right this second on that. But I do, like, there's just so many things that are messed up about this. And a lot of it, I feel like, you know, they've got parents pitted against teachers and teachers defending themselves. When really, all of this could have been avoided if our government was working the way it should be and then taking care of us instead of us just trying to keep the economy open. Basically, short story, people over profit is what a lot of this stuff boils down to.
Our guest is Christy Faust, a high school science teacher in Pinellas County who has taken a leave of absence because of the dangers of coronavirus in schools. And we're going to take some phone calls right now because we have quite a few people on the line, if that's all right with you. So I believe it is Andrew in Hardy County. Are you still on the line, Andrew?
Yes, I am. Thanks for taking my call, Sean. This is actually from the earlier segment of the show, but there's a distinct overlap here. The point I wanted to make on John's call was you heard him make that crack about, oh, some of these people are in fear for their lives. What, because they're in traffic or something? Because they're going through a normal day? That's code, and I would just about guarantee you that that guy is either closely associated with or a member of law enforcement, because that is the excuse that law enforcement has been using for years now, both to maintain qualified immunity and to give themselves the excuse to draw down on an unarmed person of color, for which there is obviously no excuse. But, you know, as your current guest was just stating, you know, the attack on public education is part of the same thing. We're talking about exactly the same thing. The maintenance of the existing order includes removing the ability of our population to be educated and be able to think deliberatively, therefore sabotage public education and remove that money. And, of course, the police have to have military-grade equipment because clearly if you're going to reduce this country's population to serfs, then you're going to have a lot of problems and there's going to have to be a lot of, enforcement of the rights of our ruling class. So thanks for taking my call, man.
All right, Andrew, thank you so much for calling in, and thanks for tying those two subjects together, and thanks for your patience. I don't know, Christy, is there anything you want to add to what Andrew was saying about schools?
Just that, you know, it occurred to me, too, like we're forcing, you know, students to go back to school, and we're going to be forcing them to go back into this testing cycle and things like that. So privatization and things, like, it gets into some of that. Again, taking away that critical thinking sort of part of education, which should be one of the more important parts, and just forcing people back in, you know, like the gentleman just said, forcing folks back in, making them think that they have to do these things, forcing them back into the, you know, to just constant standardized testing and things like that. So I definitely, some of what he said resonates, definitely.
I'm going to go back to the phones in just a second. Let me just read this one paragraph that I'm reading out of the Tampa Bay Times with assistance from Florida Politics, and then get your response before we go back to the phone line. So the Times says, on the same day lawyers wrapped up their arguments in a law school over his reopening order, Florida Education Commissioner Richard Corcoran appeared on Fox News with a new message. Not only did Corcoran expect in-person learning to resume before the end of August, but now, he told commentator Bill Hemmer, he expected all teachers assigned to those classrooms to show up or else. If they don't, then they can get terminated, said Corcoran, whose office has no power to either hire or fire school district employees, a fact he later acknowledged to Florida Politics. So, Christy, he's talking about you right there. Do you think that Richard Corcoran is going to try to get you fired, and do you think that that's right?
Well, technically, I've gone through official means, right? Like, I filled out the paperwork to take my leave of absence. I'm not just a no-show and that sort of thing. So, personally, I'm protected. But I don't think anyone should be forced to go back to unsafe working conditions. In whatever form we work, in whatever type of worker we're talking about, everyone deserves to have those sort of safeguards. Of course, different jobs look different. You know, there's different risks associated with a coal miner or something compared to a teacher. But those coal miners deserve personal protective gear that is fit for their job, and they deserve to be as safe as they can be. So the fact that he's threatening teachers to go back to these unsafe conditions, when all along we've been telling him that we think it's unsafe, and we don't think we should go back, and that we should close, and yet he hasn't been listening to us. That's basically, he's bullying people. So I absolutely don't think it's right that he's threatening folks, especially when it is not even his jurisdiction to do so. So he's throwing around threats when he doesn't have the power to do that. At least he owned it, so there's that. But very often there's been other threats that, you know, just kind of leave there hanging, and they're hoping no one will pick up on it. So, yeah, people shouldn't be forced to go back to these positions. I mean, to me, that's extortion. Go back to your job or die. You know, like, they're basically putting people in that position, and it's terrible. And just with all of my coworkers, I haven't seen anybody who feels good about this. There are people that are trying to put their best face on it, and they're going to go in, and they're going to try to make those kids feel as safe as they can and things like that. So my heart goes out to them. But it is not safe, and it's not right they're being forced back into buildings when it is unsafe.
Our guest is Christy Faust, a high school science teacher in Pinellas County. She's taking a leave of absence because she feels that it's unsafe to be teaching in-person classes and having students be learning in person at schools during this point in the coronavirus pandemic. And you're listening to WMNF Tampa, 88.5 FM. We have some people on the line, so let's go to JC in Polk County and find out what's on your mind, JC.
Hey, JC, Sean, thanks for having me on. And Christy, I commend you 100%, young lady, for your position and your stance. Our
JC, I'm not having you come through very well. I'm going to have to put you on hold and go to Jim in Port Richey. Jim, what would you like to say? You there, Jim? How about, we'll try another line. Gavin from St. Louis. Are you there, Gavin?
Hey there, how's it going? This is Gavin.
Thanks for calling in, Gavin.
Hey, so I'm from St. Louis, Missouri, and I was traveling to Washington, D.C. from Orlando, where I was protesting in front of SeaWorld. So I was doing this thing called Yeet Rushmore for the Native American people. An attempt to give all of the United States back to the Native Americans for my candidate, Mark Charles, who's running as a dual citizen for the Navajo Nation and Dutch. I'm actually traveling up to Washington, D.C. right now to meet with him, and then I'm also planning on pulling a publicity stunt with Vermin Supreme, where we plan on jello wrestling, a debate for whale force versus male force in front of the Lincoln Memorial. So I'm trying to gain publicity and notoriety for this event because my goal is to dismantle the status quo, the two-party system. And also I would like to dismantle all political parties, including the Libertarian Party, because they've become increasingly corrupt as time has gone on, especially with the new candidate, Joe Jorgensen, who plans on returning the Libertarian Party back to its roots.
Gavin, thank you. We're out of time, unfortunately, but thank you for calling in. And even though it was off topic, it was kind of entertaining to find out about your jello wrestling with Vermin Supreme. But I want to thank our guest for joining us on WMNF Midpoint today. Thank you so much, Christy.
Yeah, thank you.
Dr. Christy Faust is a high school science teacher in Pinellas County, and I want to thank everyone who called, emailed, and texted today. I want to thank Rob Lori, Frank Knox, and DT. I'm Sean Canaan. Tomorrow at noon, your hero, Mark Giro, will be back to host Midpoint Tuesday. Stay tuned right now for great Latin music on Latino 54. That's coming up after NPR headlines. And I want to thank everyone who donated during our two-day fundraiser last week. You can still donate at WMNF.org. You're listening to WMNF Tampa, St. Petersburg, Sarasota, and Lakeland. Thanks so much for listening.